Afternoon at 3 o'clock, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on Wednesday, the 11th of April, the year 2012. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk with Christina Pollock about Alaska Fellas' performance this Friday night as part of the UAS Sound and Motion Series. Becca Parks will be here to highlight the upcoming LEGO League Corporate Challenge. We'll also talk with Tom Thornton and Harold Martin about a new book on Tlingit land marketplace names. And we'll get a report on the last few days of Eagle Crest this season with Beth Weigel. And Writers' Almanac Music and more today on a Juneau afternoon. With the forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with scattered rain showers expected, low temperatures around 37 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, decreasing clouds with high temperatures and 54 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Two South Dakota reservations will receive federal money to improve dental care. As South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports, the grant money is meant to help with care in rural areas.
According to South Dakota U.S. Senator Tim Johnson, federal rural health grants totaling more than $500,000 have been awarded to three health care systems in South Dakota. One of those groups is Delta Dental, which provides dental insurance coverage across the state. That group has received more than $222,000 to provide mobile health units to the Standing Rock and Cheyenne River Sioux reservations and several other counties in the state. Another grant is going to Sacred Heart Health Services to improve access to medical care in assisted living, long-term care, and rehabilitation centers in southeast South Dakota. A third rural health care grant goes to the University of South Dakota. That money will go toward a program to bring dental hygiene students to rural low-income children while the students gain practical experience. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
An Oklahoma tribe has paid for the naming rights to Oklahoma City's minor league baseball stadium. But as Kirk Gortney with KGOU reports, the name did not sit well with many in the community.
When the Chickasaw Nation purchased the rights to rename the home of the Oklahoma Redhawks baseball team, it picked Newcastle Field at Bricktown. The tribe's choice was intended to promote a casino it operates in an Oklahoma City suburb. But local officials objected to placing a nearby town's name on the structure paid for with Oklahoma City sales taxes. Others didn't want the ballpark in the heart of the city's entertainment district associated with gambling. So 2 days later, the tribe changed the name to Chickasaw Bricktown Ballpark. A statement from Chickasaw Nation Governor Bill Anitubby said the decision to revisit the name was made because of concerns of Oklahoma City residents. The naming rights also allow the tribe to host events at the facility on the edge of downtown Oklahoma City. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
California's second largest tribe receives federal approval for its first casino. The Karuk tribe announced this week the National Indian Gaming Commission issued a positive determination for a casino in Yreka. Karuk tribal officials say the casino will provide much-needed jobs and revenue. The tribe says it's worked hard in seeking the approval and are working with state and local officials. An Arizona tribe honors its oldest members. The Hopi tribe recently held a ceremony with tribal leaders, family, and friends for some Hopi centenarians. Hopi tribal leaders emphasized the health and happiness of them and encouraged family members to care for their elderly. Two were able to attend the event, Wesley Honani, who's 103 years old, and 100-year-old Elizabeth Humitiwa. Honani is the oldest living member of the tribe. They were presented Pendleton robes, certificates, and tribal lapel pins. Not present was Marsa Balinkwa, who's 101 years old. On this day in 1968, the Indian Civil Rights Act was enacted. The act was created as a means to ensure the civil rights of Native Americans living on reservation lands. The U.S. Constitution did not provide such freedoms and rights for Indians prior to the signing of the act by President Johnson. The act was amended in later years. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Humboldt State University, part of the California State University System, offering a part-time, three-and-a-half-year online Master of Social Work program, emphasizing work in rural and indigenous communities. A new semester begins January of 2013. Applications will be accepted in August. Learn more at humboldt.edu/socialwork. Support for National Native News comes from the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:06, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our first guest today is Christina Pollack. She's involved in the group Alaska Pella. We've got a performance this Friday at 7 o'clock at the University of Alaska Southeast Egan Lecture Hall. It's part of the UAS Sound and Motion series. Christina, thank you for being on the show with us today.
Thanks for inviting me in.
First question, what is Alaska Pella?
Alaska Pella is the UAS student-led a cappella group, a cappella being only voice, no backup, no piano, no percussion.
How did you get interested in a cappella singing?
Well, I actually was in an a cappella group down in Washington, down at Seattle when I was there for University of Washington, and I just fell in love with it. I also listened to the Trenchcoats when I was a kid, and I loved that group.
So when they came to Juneau?
Yeah, they actually did come to Juneau a couple of times. I loved listening to them. They had a great Scooby-Doo version I used to love when I was a kid.
So how many people are in the group?
There are 11 people in the group. It's really neat. We've got 3 sopranos, 3 altos, 3 tenors, and 2 basses.
Want to name them, please?
All right. We've got Andrea Budbill, Stephanie Tripp, Sam Lawson on soprano, then myself, Maddie Nolan, and Amanda Jo Daniels on alto. Then we've got Thomas Eggers, Derek Grimes, and Josh Verhagen on tenor, and Grady Wright and Andre Bunton on bass.
Sounds like a lot of fun. You have fun when you rehearse?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Lots of fun. Sometimes we work really hard and it gets kind of frustrating, but it's all fun in the end. It's just working towards the concerts and making music together. It's really neat.
I know you performed last Friday as part of the first Friday show at the Jack. What other gigs have you gotten recently?
Gosh, recently. We haven't done too many other ones recently except for the JDHS concert. It was the winter concert. Let's see, it would have been in March, I believe. My memory's failing me. I do know that we did quite a few concerts in December of last year, and we did, let's see, the Chancellor's Dinner at UAS. We sang at the Alaska Youth Choir concert, their winter concert, and we also sang for the Rotary. We sang at the DIPAC holiday party. It was a lot of fun. We did a lot of caroling, a lot of fun.
How do you select your material?
Well, it's a group effort. Sometimes when the group can't decide, I'll be like, okay, I'm going to find some music and you guys tell me if you guys like it. But a lot of the times I'll go up to them and say, hey, what songs would you guys like to do? And I'll try and find it. And if they come up to me with a certain song, I'll try and come up with the song, or they will come up with the song, show it to me, and we'll get it for the group.
Do you have any favorites that everyone likes?
Ooh, Joy to the World is pretty good by Three Dog Night. It's really, really fun. I think we'll definitely be performing that at our next concert this Friday. It's a lot of fun. You guys should really come and hear it. It's really a lot of fun. We get the audience involved, too.
How do you select your material? How do you arrange your material?
Arranging? We actually haven't arranged too many pieces. There was one I did, actually, for the Christmas concert, and that was an all-guy song. It was You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch. It was a lot of fun. I just did it based on what I've heard of other a cappella arrangements, but for now, we're just doing arrangements that we have from other songs that were given to us. Or, actually, it was really neat. The Chancellor, John Pugh, gave us a little bit of money towards our club funds to get music. So we got a ton of music this time around, and we're going to be singing a few of those songs. You'll hear Viva La Vida by Coldplay. Oh, my gosh. I don't want to give away everything.
It's all happening at 7 o'clock this Friday at the University of Alaska Southeast Egan Lecture Hall. Christina Pollack, thank you for coming down. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Oh, boy. Just come on down, y'all. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Is there a charge involved?
Mm-mm. Completely free.
All right, thanks for coming down, Christina.
Yeah, thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 11th of April, 2012. It was on this day, 1976, the first Apple computer came on the market. And a year later came the Apple II. It's the birthday of Marguerite de Navarre, born in Angoulême, France, 1492. She was the daughter of a count and a mother with high aspirations for her children, so Marguerite learned Latin, Spanish, Hebrew, and Italian. She read philosophy, read the scriptures. Her younger brother Francis became the king of France, and he'd always looked up to his big sister, so he asked her to join his court, and she did, and she advised him on all sorts of things, on diplomatic affairs, and why he should employ Leonardo da Vinci and Benvenuto Cellini at the royal court, and why he should try to reform the Catholic Church. She tried to mediate the religious conflict between Catholics and Protestants, and to protect reformers like John Calvin, even though she didn't agree with him. It's the birthday of Dorothy Allison, born Greenville, South Carolina, 1949. Grew up desperately poor, but she was inspired by the confidence that her teachers and classmates had in her. She said, because they did not see poverty and hopelessness as a foregone conclusion for my life, I could begin to imagine other futures for myself. She was the first person in her family to go to college, and there in the late 60s, she was introduced to the feminist movement, which she said was like opening your eyes underwater. Wrote a memoir about her childhood and family history called Two or Three Things I Know for Sure, and wrote a novel, Bastard Out of Carolina, which she's best known for. Dorothy Allison, who said, people want biography, people want memoir. They want you to tell them that the story you're telling them is true. The thing I'm telling you is true, but it did not always happen to me. It's the birthday of the poet Mark Strand, born on Prince Edward Island, Canada, in 1934. It's the birthday of poet Christopher Smart, born in Shipbourne, England, 1722, who experienced a religious awakening that convinced him that he was a prophet, and he began praying and preaching in the streets of London, and tried to follow the biblical injunction to pray ceaselessly, and he would drop to his knees whenever the Spirit moved him, which embarrassed his family, and they put him into an asylum, where he wrote the two poems for which he's best known, A Song to David and Jubilate Agno, which includes a section praising his cat. It's our poem for today, Christopher Smart. For I will consider my cat Jeffrey, for he is the servant of the living God, duly and daily serving him. For at the first glance of the glory of God in the east, he worships in his way. For is this done by wreathing his body seven times round with elegant quickness? For he keeps the Lord's watch in the night against the adversary. For he is of the tribe of Tiger. For he purrs in thankfulness when God tells him he's a good cat. For he is an instrument for the children to learn benevolence upon. For every house is incomplete without him, and the blessing is lacking in the spirit. For he is the cleanest in the use of his forepaws of any quadruped. For he is the quickest to his mark of any creature. For there is nothing sweeter than his peace when at rest. For there is nothing brisker than his life when in motion. For by stroking of him, I have found out electricity. Christopher Smart, from his long poem, Jubilate Agno. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Time is 3:14 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guests are here to talk about this LEGO League Corporate Challenge. Becca Parks with the STEM IT program at the University of the Juneau Economic Development Council and works with the first robotics program in the Alaska Development Corporation. Also Hannah Logger and Will Belknap are two of the three members in last year's winning Corporate Challenge team, the LEGO Maniacs. Thank you for coming down to the station, everybody.
Thanks for having us.
Hello.
So first of all, Becca, if you could tell us about the LEGO League Corporate Challenge in general.
Sure. And, you know, I'll start the LEGO League, for folks that don't know, is actually a kids program. It's a league just like basketball or soccer leagues, but it's for robotics. And it's for ages 9 to 14. We have about 150 teams in the state, and they're all over the place. Just in Juneau, we have teams at each one of our elementary and middle schools. And it's just one of those things that gets kids really engaged in problem-solving thinking, what we want to see our kids working on in school, outside of school, as clubs. They have a ton of fun doing it. And every year, our biggest problem in supporting what kids want to do is finding them coaches and mentors. So what we've done is come up with this corporate challenge, and it's a way to get adults engaged in that same activity and hopefully recruit them into being coaches and mentors for follow-up seasons. So what the corporate challenge is teams of adults competing with LEGO robots on a 4-foot by 8-foot table doing, it's sort of like an obstacle course. They have to complete different missions, push something into a place, knock something over, turn something a certain way, and figure out how to do as many of those things in 2.5 minutes as they can.
Do you get any extra credit for the same? Can you do the same one over and over again?
Nope. You've got to figure out a way to get the most points. So each thing that the robot does is worth a different amount of points. So there's a lot of strategy and pre-planning involved. And these guys can actually talk about what goes into getting ready for the competition better than I can.
Will, you've done it for this your third year?
Yes, this is my third year. I did it for the first time 3 years ago, because my son, being in elementary school, wanted to join a LEGO team, and they didn't really have a coach going into the fall. So I saw it as a great way to get exposed to it, to see how hard it is, to see whether I could coach a team. And it turns out that it's very easy to learn how to manipulate the robot, but it's very difficult to complete the tasks. So that's why I jumped into it. And then I take... One of the core values of the LEGO League is that the kids do the work. And so although every team has an adult coach, the kids are supposed to be the ones solving the problem. And so as a coach, you know, watching the kids do the challenges, you have to really keep your mouth shut, you know, on any ideas you might have. And so now it's just fun to do the corporate challenge where you can try and implement your own ideas that you thought might have worked and maybe they don't work, but you get to find out.
And with that, we do have three coaches from this season that are all on different teams for the corporate challenge. So I think a lot of people have that same need to compete when they're keeping their mouths shut with their teams in the fall.
Do you have any secret strategies that you want to share with us?
No way. Not in case somebody's listening from one of the other teams. I will say, though, it can take as much time as you want to put into it. It takes a very small amount of time to learn how to get the robot to drive. It's both an engineering and a sort of a logic challenge. I mean, you have to build the robot from scratch. So you have to design the robot to actually stay upright, to roll a certain speed, to be able to do turns. And then on the second part is actually engineer it to manipulate items on the table or to fit around things.
Seems like you would have an advantage having done it before versus somebody who's never seen a LEGO before in their life.
Somewhat. You also... You know, you can tend to overthink it or a lot of things don't pan out the way you think it will. So, you know, I would encourage anybody to jump in and try it as an adult or to coach kids in the fall, because it's something that, you know, these are 9, 10, 11-year-olds that are picking up and doing it, and they can learn how to get the robot to drive around just in a few minutes on the computer. So yeah.
The corporate challenge is this Friday at the Bearnut from 4 to 6 p.m.
It's on May 4th.
Oh, May 4th, I'm sorry.
So we've got a while. But we are encouraging. We want some more teams to sign up. We have 7 teams so far, and we even have one team coming down from Anchorage. It's a great fundraiser and, again, a great way for people to get involved. It's $200 to register a team. You don't have to be a corporation. It can just be a group of adults. The LEGO Maniacs are just people that sign up. They pay out of pocket and do it to support the league and to have a lot of fun. So you don't have to build the best robot in the for the challenge, just put something together, show up on May 4th, and then May 4th is a great time for spectators to come out. And you, Hannah, you want to talk a little bit about the event?
The event is way fun. It's crazy, and it always goes way faster than you think it's going to go. And it's the other thing I really like about it is that the spectators get to get up all nice and real close to the table, which is great from a viewer's perspective because you get to see really how the robot functions and how the table works, especially if you're not real familiar with it beforehand. But from a team perspective, that adds extra little variables in there for you, you know, whether somebody is a little too close to the table or whether at the last minute in 2.5 minutes you kind of freak out and something goes wrong on the table. It's really a lot of fun, really fast-paced.
Yeah, and it's we have our MC, Andy Klein, comes out. He'll be there again this year, and our head referee, Caroline Schultz. So some volunteers from the community come out just to support the teams, and it's open to anyone. There's no charge to come watch. It's at the Baranoff, so you've got the hotel bar there if you want to grab a beer and come in and watch that way. It's a lot different than the kids' tournament in the fall. We let the teams have a little bit more fun, so there's some play with the rules, and we're going to add in an extra round this year that's really a no-rules type round, so they can take their first three rounds seriously, and then that fourth round, we're just going to let them mess with the other team, play around, send out two rope, whatever they can think of, we're going to see what they can come up with.
And the theme this year is?
It's food factor, so all of the missions on the table have to do with food safety.
Can you give us a hint as to what they might look like?
There's a thermometer. There's a pig and a cow. Those are my favorites. Do you guys have a...
Well, you know, you can harvest the fish. You got to clean up the viruses and bacteria out of us, you know, and deliver them to the sink. I mean, it's all food safety related.
You have to pick up the pizza and ice cream.
Yeah.
Next year is Senior Solutions is next year's LEGO League theme. So I have no idea what the LEGO engineers are going to come up with for the table next year.
Will you get LEGOs to practice with once you sign up?
You will. We'll give you a full LEGO robotics kit and the full table set up to practice with.
Sounds fun, and I guess that's by word of fun and also fundraising.
Yes. Fundraising is a big part, $200 per team, and that money goes directly back into our programs to support the teams here in Southeast.
And you're suggesting that spectators are welcome as well?
Yeah, we highly encourage spectators of all ages. If you're under 21, you do need a parent or guardian that's over 21 to attend. But yeah, family friendly, it's just a great evening to come out and watch.
How many people are involved at a younger age who aren't in the corporate challenge?
Across the state, in the FIRST Robotics programs, K-12, we have over 2,000 students that participate in our programs.
All right, and if people want to sign up, how can they do that?
Go to FLLAlaska.com, and there's a link right there on the homepage.
All right, Becca Parks, Hannah Logger, and Will Belknap. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I guess I should add, you can also just call me for information, 523-2334. And I'd also encourage you to check out all of our STEM education programs at stemak.org. There's lots of different ways to get involved with tinkering, building, playing with Legos, whatever you like. We're just looking to get people engaged and having fun.
This all happens Friday, May 4th at the Baranoff Hotel from 4 to 6 p.m. And if you'd like to pre-register, that phone number again?
523-2334.
All right. Thank you for coming down again. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Yes.
Nope. Thank you.
Would you recommend this to other people?
Oh, definitely.
And why?
Definitely. It is a whole lot of fun for yourself. It's a challenge, you know, for the mind to try and solve these problems. The entire table is made out of Legos, and you get to build with Legos as an adult with a legitimate, you know, reason not to be ashamed of it. And so if you enjoyed playing with Legos as a kid, you'd love this. Or if you're... you know, like computers, you'd love it. Or if you just want a challenge, you know, come on down. The more teams, the better.
If you think you can beat the kids' score, definitely pick it up. Because that
which hasn't happened yet. Our kids have always had higher scores than our adult teams. So maybe this year that'll change.
Any reason why?
Maybe time commitment and maybe creativity. Who knows?
All right. Becca Parks, Hannah Logger, and Will Belknap, thank you very much for coming down to the station today and talking about the first LEGO League. Appreciate you coming down.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks.
brand new version of Here Comes the Sun by George Harrison, done by David Lanz. Time is 3:28, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Book crossed on our desk the other day here at the Case Station. It's called Our Grandparents' Names on the Land. It's there every Friday book signing at Zilaz Kapaza. I'd like to introduce Tom Ferdinand, who's the editor, and Harold Marvin, who oversaw much of the research. It's a landmark atlas. In fact, you could probably describe it best, Tom.
Yeah, it was basically the results of about two decades of research, not full-time, but collecting place names from different historical sources, anthropological sources, and then finally, with Harold's help, we steered a grant through Tlingit and Haida and the Southeast Native Subsistence Commission to work with all of the major tribes in the region to document mainly Tlingit and Haida place names, but also other native place names on the land, and produce this book, which has a chapter on each kwan or community and about 3,000 place names.
Harold Martin, could you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Harold Martin. I'm a Tlingit. I was born and raised in Cape, Alaska, and but my ancestral home is in Hoona. I graduated from Western Washington University in Bellingham and did my graduate studies at the University of Alaska, Juneau. I went to work for Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska in 1982, and I worked as a tribal operations officer up until 1994. When the self-governance office came in and there's no longer any need for a tribal operations officer. And I was transferred to the subsistence office where I was appointed as director. And shortly after, I was also serving as president of the Southeast Native Subsistence Commission. And shortly after that, Tom came and brought the idea of a Tlingit Place Names Project.
Where did the idea come from in the first place, Tom?
Well, before I ever came to Alaska, I got interested in place names. Really started off when I used to canoe in eastern Canada. There were a lot of native names on the land. And one of the ones we ran into was the name for a big lake called Temagami. And it turned out it meant deep waters, and it was a lake that was over 1,000 feet deep, and it was one of those names that had a very nice sound to it, nice ring to it, but it was also very descriptive of the lake itself. And after that, I sort of tried to take note of place names whenever I came across them. And when I first came to Southeast Alaska, I had already read the work of Frederica de Laguna and some of the other scholars of Tlingits in particular up here, and had become familiar with some of the names, although I had no idea of how to pronounce them or what their significances were.
Were there any rules of thumb when naming places in traditional names, traditional times?
Yeah, I think there are. I mean, almost every culture, to begin with, has place names, and almost every culture in the world has generic terms. You know, just like in English, you have a generic term for rivers or bays, things like that. You find the same thing in Tlingit. And you also have a phenomenon of binomial compounds where you have the generic river and then some kind of modifier to begin with, big river, small river, sockeye, salmon river, whatever. And that's another common pattern in Tlingit. But some other patterns you see are metaphoric naming. The most natural environment that we use to name the landscape with is our own body. And so again, in English, you can talk about the mouth of a river or the arm of a lake. And in Tlingit, it follows from that as well. And then another pattern is called metonymic naming, and that's when a part of the landscape stands for the whole thing. So if you have several places around Southeast Alaska that are called Kwat'ani, which refer to eggs, bird eggs, and there are places where people went to collect bird eggs, and so that name comes to stand, or that activity really comes to stand for the place. So those are some of the major patterns that you find.
The book is published by the Sea Alaska Heritage Foundation in association with the University of Washington Press. It's all about landmarks, but it's truly a landmark book.
Well, we hope so. We hope it's a resource that will be used by educators, by individual Tlingit people who want to understand their landscape and their ancestral heritage, but also by anyone who's interested really in the history and geography of Southeast Alaska. And a lot of people thought these names were lost, but in fact they weren't. A lot of them were documented in sources, but a lot of them were still alive in people's minds and memories. And we feel very fortunate that we got a lot of cooperation on this project to document names in every community.
So with 3,000 Tlingit Haida and other names illustrated with maps, charts, photographs, it's got over 230 pages in it. It's an amazing reference book. Do you think you're finished yet? Is there a chapter two?
Well, I think one experience we had, I did my dissertation on the concept of place and Tlingit, and I always thought I could collect all the names first before I finished, and I finally gave up on that idea and published a separate book about sort of the sense of place and kept collecting. And it took a while, and then we thought, at this point, we'll publish this book, but we know anytime you go back to a community, there's a possibility of gathering more names. And then there's certainly sources that are out there, historical sources, journals, things like that, that probably have additional names that we haven't documented. So I think, as with the Dictionary of Alaska Place Names, there have to be supplements and additions. And hopefully there'll be new names on the land, because that's a tradition that's very important in Tlingit and Haida, is to continue to name places. And you do see that. You saw it, for example, with the middle school here being named Zemtikahini. That was after Gold Creek. That's an old name being used to designate a new feature, a man-made feature. But you also have examples of new names being put on the land. And that's probably as it should be for a living culture.
You want to talk a little bit about the difference between traditional names and Western names?
Yeah. Well, one of the differences I often remark upon is when you look at the same landscape that has two sets of names. And one place where we did that was in Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve. And the English name set is dominated by what you might call biographical names, commemorative of individual people. And so scientists have glaciers named after them, explorers have glaciers named after them, or they name them after the people who supported their expedition. And that's a strong tradition in America, but in Tlingit, you almost never see that. Usually it's the opposite. The people are named after the places rather than the places being named after the people. So a lot of individuals derive their names, their personal names, from events that occurred at places, and most major clans take their name from a place. And that's a different dynamic when instead of sort of commodifying the land as property of an individual or named after an individual, you're essentially attaching your identity to the land. One other difference that we saw in Glacier Bay is the fact that in Tlingit you can express relationships between features in a fairly complex way that's difficult to do in English in a name. And the example is Glacier Bay itself was supposedly named after the Tlingit name for the bay. And but that name in Tlingit, Sit-i-ti-ge-i, means literally bay taking the place of the glacier. And obviously that's about seven words or something in English. You couldn't really stick that in a place name, so they reduced it to Glacier Bay, a classic binomial compound, by the way. But the Tlingit idea is really more complex than that. It's expressing the geomorphological reality that the glacier is receding and the bay is taking its place. And to me, that's very significant of the capacity of Tlingit to express those kinds of relationships.
I'm talking with Tom Thornton, editor, and Harold Martin, who oversaw the research in a book called Our Grandparents' Names on the Land. Harold, could you share with us the Tlingit name for it, please?
It means our, you know, so I said our grandparents' names on the land.
And can you describe your role in the project?
Pardon me?
Could you describe your role in the project?
Well, in 1994, when I became a subsistence director, we were involved in many different subsistence issues for Ladd and Nilka. And Tom was at the time, had just resigned from the State Fish and Game Department Subsistence Division and went to work at the University of Alaska as an anthropologist. And he came to me with the idea of a document in Tlingit place names. And we talked at length about what was happening, that our elders were, we were losing our elders at a rapid pace. And every time we lost an elder, we lost a lot of history and knowledge. And so it became very important that we document Tlingit place names. We applied for and received grants from the National Park Service Historical Preservation Funds. And first thing we had to do was go out into the villages and get permission to proceed with the project. We couldn't just go ahead on our own. We had to get permission from the federally recognized tribal governments. Each community is settled by one certain clan, and some other clans move in for some reason or another. But we had to get permission from the clan that settled that actual area. Fortunately, we were blessed with permission from every community we went to, and we planned this whole thing. I administered the project. Tom did all the technical work.
And there's a lot of work involved, wasn't there?
A lot of work. Still going on, actually. This by no means a finished product. I mean, we did what we could, but like Tom said, from time to time, new names come up, and we're hoping sometime in the future we'll add all that to the place names list.
I would disagree that Harold was only administering the grant. He was also a source for Tlingit place names, and that I think it was very valuable, particularly in Cake, where he's from. You know, his role in the project, and I know that he kept saying he didn't remember a lot of names, but it turned out, in fact, when we went to Cake and we started talking to the elders older than him, and they mentioned names, he would actually be pointing them out on the map, so he actually did know them. And I think that's probably true of a lot of people his generation. They actually think they've forgotten them, but actually they're there because they were used when they were young, and they remember them in reference to actual places. But unless they're in the right context, they can't necessarily volunteer them out of memory. So it turned out he proved to be one of our valuable sources for place names in Cake.
What do you think is going to be one of the greatest legacies of the book?
Well, I think the greatest legacy, I think, the names are on maps and that they're remembered, because they unlock really so much. When people lay down names in an oral culture like Tlingit, they're often, as we said, very descriptive of the land, but they can also be significant of events that occurred there, relationships between peoples and various landscapes. And it also can describe the richness and biodiversity and other things that exist. Even the abiotic environment is very well described in Tlingit place names. So I think they're a valuable cultural resource for their history, but they're also a valuable resource to understand the natural history and evolution of the region. Southeast Alaska is one of the most dynamic environments in the world in terms of how it's changed with glaciation, deglaciation, isostatic rebound, and a lot of those changes are actually marked in the names, Glacier Bay being an example of that.
Yeah, bear in mind that a lot of these names were in existence long before the first Europeans came to this country. And so when I was growing up on my dad's boat, Tlingit was the principal language in the home. And that's all they talked. Like when we're going fishing, my dad, he would never say, "We're going to go to Saginaw Bay." He says, "Kanach derach tirkuch." It means we're going to Saginaw Bay. But that's how, you know, we had to report all that. And at the time, it was, you know, the subsistence issues were pretty hot. And I ran into state agencies, federal agencies, and saying, conservationists saying that there's no evidence that certain areas were ever used by natives for subsistence purposes. All that they do is look at our chart, and there's no place in Southeast Laos that wasn't used at one time or another, or for one reason or another. And the importance of the names themselves, I think, Tom described it best when he said that, he said, for Southeast Alaska Natives, the most fundamental subsistence resource is the land itself. Indigenous place names are valuable linguistic artifacts containing a wealth of cultural and environmental information concerning our region's land and waters. I thought that described the place names very well.
The book is called Our Grandparents' Names on the Land. It's a very scholarly book, but Tom, I would venture to say that you didn't design it just for scholars.
No, it's hopefully be of use to anyone, whether, as I said, they're an individual trying to understand their ancestral landscapes or a resource manager trying to plan something and to protect cultural resources. I can see lots of uses, and I think one use that's already been requested is names to be used in developing kind of place-based education curricula in schools, and I think starting with names is a very good way to do that, because as I said, every culture has place names. They're one of the most fundamental ways that we orient ourselves to the land, and for all of our valuable GPS tools and everything else, we still need names to orient us and to stimulate our memories and senses of place. So I hope it will do that.
In one of Tom's earlier versions of a book, after we completed the charts, he included a CD in the back of the book, and put it in your computer, and the map shows up, and the names come out, and you put your cursor on the name. It gives you the exact pronunciation. It tells you what the name means and where it came from. We couldn't do that with this book. That's perhaps another project. We probably have to go to each community to get permission to do that for their certain areas.
Yeah. I've been talking with Harold Martin and Tom Thornton about the book, Our Grandparents' Names on the Land, published by the Sea Alaska Heritage Foundation in association with the University of Washington Press. Available for book signing tomorrow it's Friday at noon at the Sea Alaska Plaza. What's the cover price on the book, Tom?
I think the paperback is $30, and the hardback is
$60.
Yeah.
All right, anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I would say that the benefit, the proceeds benefit Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, so that's another helpful legacy of the book, is that it will generate proceeds that contribute to more cultural projects like this one.
I'd like to just express my appreciation and thank the Sea Alaska Heritage Foundation or Institute for publishing the book.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to thank you for being my guest today on a Juneau afternoon. Thank you for coming by.
Thanks.
Welcome.
They were building a school in the Lemon Creek Valley. It was kind of a middle school, not too far from the jail or the landfill, and they thought long and hard about what they might call it. There were many suggestions, proposals, proponents, opponents, but only one of them was chosen, and some hard words were spoken. Not the least of which was Suntikahini. They called it Suntikahini. Suntikahini. They called it Suntikahini. Now Zunti is the flounder, and heen is fresh water, a stream or a river. The K apostrophe in the middle is diminutive, and the I at the end is possessive. The little water of the flounder. Suntikahini.
They called it Zantikahini. Zantikahini. They called it Zantikahini. But it seems that our culture is disrespectful of flounders, because lately to flounder means to flip-flop, stumble, and blunder. But if I were to zanti, I wonder just what would that be. Yes, if I were to zanti all over the floor, would you still love me? Would you call out for more? Zantikahini. They called it Zantikahini. Zantikahini. Zantikahini.
John Palms. More about that song can be found at johnpalms.com. That's JohnPalmes. Time is 3:49. You are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our last guest for today is Beth Weigel, talking about end-of-season activities at Eagle Crest. Beth, thank you for coming down the station.
Thanks, Jeff.
First of all, how was your Discovery Auction and dinner?
Oh, it was a smashing success. We had so many people there, and we just want to send out a big thanks to everybody who attended and donated, and we may have a record-breaking year, so we're very excited about that.
So we're in the last few days of Eagle Crest season for this year.
Well, it's going to be a record-breaking weather week, I think, too, for Eagle Crest. But we've got lots of fun things scheduled for the last weekend, which is this weekend. On Saturday is the Slush Cup. We're calling it the Dash and Splash weekend. So Saturday is the Slush Cup. We want everybody to dress up in some sort of retro ski gear. That's the costume theme for the Slush Cup this year.
Could you describe the Slush Cup for those of us who haven't been to
one?
Oh,
the Slush Cup is we build a big pond at the bottom of Lower Hillary's, right near the race shack, and folks try to basically come down half of Hillary's and then transition from snow to water and ski across the pond and somehow make it to the other side without going under.
And are many successful?
Oh, yeah, there's always a bunch of successful folks, and there's always the folks that don't really make it too far and end up in the water. But we do keep some rescue divers in there. It's not a terribly deep pond, but you can definitely get disoriented when you've got your skis on and such in the pond.
Have you made the attempt yourself?
No, I haven't done it myself, but I have certainly narrated many people's successful and unsuccessful attempts across while being the MC for the event.
So besides the Slush Cup, there's other activities going on this weekend?
Yeah, so just so folks know, we do need you to register for the Slush Cup up down at the Day Lodge between 9 and 11 in the morning, and then the event starts at 1:30. And there is a little bit of an entry fee, $5 for 17 and under, $10 for adults. And then the other event going on Saturday is called the Dash Downhill. It's going to be for some smaller, younger kids, a little bit more fun for them over on the Porcupine area. And from 10 to 12, the folks are going to build a fun relay / obstacle course. And it'll be some fun little challenges for folks to get through, and we'll also have our adaptive gear out, so anybody who's interested in maybe trying the bi-ski or the sit-ski or something like that, they can check that out. So Orca's going to be around demonstrating some of that equipment as well. So should be a fun day on Saturday, and then the last day of the season is Sunday, and we just encourage everybody to get out, use the lift while you can, and enjoy that last day. It looks like the weather's going to be cooperative this weekend again, and I tell you, the conditions in the afternoon particularly have just been delightful spring skiing, so it just slushes right up, and it's really just very soft and fun skiing.
Would you say this has been a record-breaking year for Eagle Crest?
Well, we never did top the amount of snow we had at the top several years ago, but we still have a lot of snow up there. There's still over 100 inches at the bottom of the mountain, over 150 inches at the top of the mountain. It's been an excellent year as far as the snow and conditions go, so we couldn't have asked for a better year considering most of the places down south are already closed up and kind of their seasons were a lot shorter, so we should be thankful for what we got, I guess.
And how did the Easter Bunny do last Sunday?
Oh, you know, the Easter Bunny, he had a little bit of a chase on his hands when the older kids got after him, the kids that were 12 and older, or 7 and older, I guess, but the 10 and 12-year-olds really go after him. And I did see his foot slip out from under him and had to do a little bit of a roll and recovery, but he still managed to get down the hill and onto the ptarmigan and escaped yet again with his tail, so his tail was intact at the end of the day.
That's good. So if you need more information about Eagle Crest, you can go to their website, which is
SkiJuno.com. And you can also give us a call up at the mountain at 790-2000 if you have a question. And I think there will be some limited lessons available on Saturday and Sunday, but you'll need to make a reservation in advance.
Is there anything people need to know about registering for the Slush Cup?
Just that you need to do it in the morning. If you get to the top of the hill there and don't have your registration, you won't be able to be in it. So you do need to sign some forms and that kind of stuff.
I'm Beth Weigel. Thank you for coming in and talking about Eagle Crest. Anything else going on that you want to talk about?
Just don't miss the last weekend at Eagle Crest. It's going to be a great, great time, and we all mourn the end of it and rejoice the end as well. So just don't miss it.
All right. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Just a little downhill fun. Snowflakes are falling, a mountain is calling, crowd shouts out from below. 5, 4, 3, 2, all eyes upon you, now it's time to go. Every muscle straining, 1,000 hours of training, all hanging on this run. Swearing in your stories that cheating death or glory is just a little downhill fun. Hanging by your edges, high above the ledges, every gate is just a blur. Voices calling faster, dancing with disaster, speed's the deadly lure. Every muscle straining, 1,000 hours of training, all hanging on this run. Swearing in your stories that cheating death for glory is just a little downhill fun. Just a little downhill fun. Slicing through the bitter air, rockets on the white ice, carving up your paradise, only a racer can share. Every muscle straining, 1,000 hours of training, all hanging on this run. Swearing in your stories that cheating death for glory is just a little downhill fun. Coming off that last turn, feet numb and legs burned, like a bullet from a gun. Knees chatter, knees shake, every bone and nerve aches, 200 seconds and you're done. Every muscle straining, 1,000 hours of training, all hanging on this run. Swearing in your stories that cheap death or glory is just a little downhill fun. Just a little downhill. Snowflakes are falling, a mountain is calling, the crowd shouts out from below.